news, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia and a bunker below ground, welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks program. Glad, as always, to be getting behind the microphone and getting into gear where the ancient world, where humanity's future, yes, all these things meet and convene within the modern mind. So let's dive into things, shall we? Ancient cave art, Apollo landers, space station detectors, all of this awaits and more. And of course, oh, we've got to throw in a little Corona Somnia. All of that in the news this week, but the big question on our mind has to do with what we're celebrating all week. In fact, happy ET week. ET as in the kind that phones home if and when they visit, and it is the contention of one Harvard scientist that maybe we actually have been visited, and that scientific proof for that alien visitation exists. Dr. Avi Loeb will be my guest later in the program, and we will be discussing the enigmatic Oumuamua. That, a bit of philosophy of science, and much more. So, very excited for the program this week. I hope everyone had a great weekend. Hope you're just doing great overall, by the way. You know, years ago when we started this program, we used to talk about cosmic love a lot. And so I'm sending a little your way. Wherever you may be, whatever may be happening in your life, maybe I'm just saying all this because it's an exceptionally dreary day above ground, above the bunker, where I am broadcasting from. But in any case, glad to be here as always, and making sure those studio monitors are turned all the way down. That's right. Sometimes we monitor this broadcast in real time. We want to make sure that everyone else down here isn't doing the same. So, what's happening? What's new? How are you doing? Actually, I'd love to hear from you if you'd like to actually pass along how you're doing at Micah Hanks on Twitter. info@MicahHanks.com is the email. I've got a few of those I want to get to a little later. But first, getting to the news that has been curated by the one and only Mrs. Lauren Ellis. This one, of course, naturally gets my attention. Archaeologists, according to the BBC, have discovered the world's oldest known animal cave painting in Indonesia. The painting was made using dark red ochre pigment, and it depicts, well, before I tell you, actually use your imagination for a moment. If we were to enter the ancient mind, what would you expect? One of the earliest known representations of not just animal art, but also art in general. What would you expect that to depict? Okay, now that everyone has an image in their mind, I'll go ahead and I'll tell you. It is believed to be a Sulawesi warty pig. That's right, a variety of wild pig. That was what was depicted on this ancient cave wall. I think that's kind of cute, in truth, even though in likelihood the artist would have been a hunter or would have survived off of hunting and gathering as humans in that era did. So this little guy, more than being a depiction of wildlife, this was probably what was on his mind because that's what he intended to have for dinner that night. But nonetheless, it is endearing in many ways to think that 45,500 years ago or so, based on the pigment that was found on this cave wall, there was someone in Indonesia painting pigs. Now, according to the BBC, the picture was found in what is known as the Liang Terongenge Cave, in a remote valley on the island of Sulawesi, the same from which the pig derives its full name. And this is believed to provide the earliest evidence also, not only of the art in question, but of human settlement of that region. And this is an important point to raise also. When we look at ancient cave art, sometimes we are actually struck by how sophisticated it is. I'm not as struck by that. I find it no less remarkable, mind you. But I'm actually not as struck by it. And the reason why is because I'm aware, hyper aware, if anything, of this modern attitude of quote-unquote primitive people in early times. These were anatomically modern humans. I mean, really, in terms of their capabilities, the development of their brain at that time, they were no different from us. Of course, they were fantastic artists in many cases. And those same ideas were essentially reflected by Maxim Aubert, co-author of the report, by the way, which was published in Science Advances. Aubert said, "The people who made it were fully modern. They were just like us. They had all of the capacity and the tools to do any painting that they liked. And, as evidenced by the 45,500-year-old remnants on this particular cave wall, they were fairly good at it." And I'm looking at the pig in question right now. It's actually quite a good representation. Something else that's very interesting, too, that you see are the hands, presumably, of the artist. And what they would often do, I've actually seen recreations of this. This wouldn't have been very fun, per se. But the artists presumably took the paint and put it in their mouths. And then they placed their hand on the cave wall, and then they spat the paint all over their hand and the cave wall. And then when they removed their hand, of course, the shape of their hand was left. I remember as a child watching a program, maybe on PBS, where this ancient painting technique was recreated for the camera, and I remember thinking to myself, boy, that has got to taste really great. Putting chalk or ochre or whatever else might have been used into your mouth and then spitting that all over your hand and effectively leaving a signature. Artists today sign their paintings. Why wouldn't they have done it in the ancient past? And so I'm fascinated by the fact that this 45,500-year-old pig on this cave wall also has a signature by the artist or artists. There are two hands. And it really kind of makes you think about the things that we leave behind. I mean, that was an intentional gift to future generations, but we often take for granted the footprint that we leave on the world. Speaking of footprints, by the way, a great example. The boot prints left by astronauts who have walked on the surface of the moon. I wonder if the astronauts, when they went there, and they were changing history, the first humans to set foot on an object in space, planet, moon, or otherwise, the first ones to ever do this, I can't help but wonder if they ever thought the very footprints that they left behind would one day be treasured as a part of history, very much like the ichnofossil footprints of early humans that have been preserved for thousands of years are today by archaeologists. That's right, in very rare instances we have human footprints more than several thousands of years old, sometimes even more than that, if we go to sites in parts of Ethiopia and places where, again, fossil footprints left by early human ancestors are still visible today. But very much in that tradition of leaving footprints in the sands of time, astronauts did the same thing on the surface of the moon, and in this article that Lawrence and Long from The Conversation, they note, it's hard to care about boot prints sunk in soil 238,900 miles away as humanity suffers the combined burden of an unforgiving virus and, of course, all the political change and unease occurring right now. But they note how humans treat those boot prints and the historic lunar landing sites upon which they are now found will speak volumes about who we humans are and who we seek to become. And so on December 31st, there was an act passed known as the One Small Step to Protect Human Heritage in Space Act. This became law, and as they report, they say it's pretty benign. It requires companies that are working with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration on lunar missions to agree to be bound by otherwise unenforceable guidelines intended to protect American landing sites on the moon. And as they note, it is the first law ever enacted by any nation that recognizes the existence of human heritage in outer space. That's a really, really important thing to keep in mind. And as they note further in the article, the reason it's important, as Michelle L. D. Hanlon, professor of air and space law at the University of Mississippi, points out, is because it reaffirms our human commitment to protecting our history, as we do on Earth with sites. And she gives an example of Machu Picchu. Again, we could include the cave in Indonesia where an ancient artist 45,000 plus years ago decided to leave a pig for future generations to marvel at. It's very important that we protect our history. It is incredibly important. And so I'm glad that this is indeed something we are looking at as far as the moon goes. But Michelle further states, I'm a lawyer who focuses on space issues that seek to ensure the peaceful and sustainable exploration and use of space. She says, I believe that people can achieve world peace through space. I wonder if our guest, Dr. Avi Loeb, would agree. I bet he would. But Michelle says, to do so, we must recognize landing sites on the moon and other celestial bodies as the universal human achievements that they are, built on the research and dreams of scientists and engineers spanning centuries on this globe. I would have to agree, but she also points out something that I think is really important to drive home, especially in this day and age. She says, I believe that the One Small Step Act, which was enacted in a divisive political environment, demonstrates that space and preservation truly are nonpartisan, even unifying principles. You know, I've seen a lot of pushback from various journalists about the Space Force over the last few years. I think a lot of people mistake it for being something, for instance, only of importance to the last administration. I've even seen calls by journalists for the new presidential administration to abolish the Space Force because they perceive it as a new idea. And in fact, I've talked about this in a weekly newspaper that is produced every week over at thedebrief.org that my colleagues Tim and MJ and Steve and myself and others contribute to on a weekly basis. But yes, I actually write our official newsletter, the Intelligence Brief. And in that weekly newsletter, I cover everything from space to defense to UFOs and other things that are happening and timely. But I've talked about the fact that those who have called for the abolishment of the Space Force must be completely unaware of the fact that even prior to 9/11, which in a lot of ways was a turning point in American history for a number of different reasons, but prior to 9/11, which ultimately ended up somewhat overshadowing the considerations being put toward the future of space and exploration in space at that time, Donald Rumsfeld actually led a government study which looked at space and what would be required for the U.S. to be able to maintain a presence and remain key players in the outer space domain. And the ultimate conclusion of this study, carried out way back in the day during the George W. Bush administration, had been, we need a separate branch of the military that looks exclusively at space rather than this just being a side project for the U.S. Air Force. And there have been other government assessments and studies that looked at the same thing over the years. And in fact, if you go back, the very first episode of this podcast from last year, January 2020, had been devoted to the Space Force, and we looked at all those considerations at that time. And so I guess, yeah, it irks me a bit when I'm seeing journalists politicize things like the future involvement in space, and they apparently don't have a full understanding of how long people have been arguing that we need a Space Force and that we need to be thinking about not only the future of space exploration, colonization of other planets, returning to the moon and what have you, but also the very real and apparent consideration that must be given to the use of space for military purposes. Or more importantly, the idea that other nations, especially those that are adversarial to the U.S., might seek to do the same thing. In fact, they almost inevitably do. And so as Michelle points out in her op-ed there at The Conversation, yes, it is indeed inspiring, and it's incredibly important that despite the political differences we have down here on this mud ball circling our sun, that there is unity, and there are common goals that we can achieve despite all of that. And these certainly speak to the fact that here on Earth, if aliens were ever to visit, they're not going to arrive and say, okay, guys, Democrats over here, Republicans over there, Americans here, English here, Australians there, Chinese here, Russians over there, please. I don't think E.T. would see the same distinctions if they arrived. And maybe, at times, here on Earth, it would be important for us to remember that we're all, above all else, first and foremost, Earthlings. That should always be the most important thing. All right, we've got a little more news to cover in the next segment, and I've got some listener emails I want to get to before we get Dr. Avi Loeb on the mic with us to discuss Oumuamua and much more right here on the Micah Hanks Program. take my soul. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad to be your host. Every week as we go in pursuit of the enigmatic, I'm looking at something right now. A photograph taken from the International Space Station that is sure to raise some eyebrows, maybe more than that. If I had to compare this to anything, it would look a lot like a giant blue lightsaber rising out of clouds and projected towards space, creating an incredible halo in the sky or the upper atmosphere above. So what exactly are we looking at here? According to sciencenews.org, this photograph represents a very rare type of upper atmosphere lightning, and apparently we now know the cause of it. According to Maria Temming, writing for Science News, she says blue jets, as they're known, zip upward from thunderclouds into the stratosphere, reaching altitudes of about 50 kilometers in less than a second. Whereas ordinary lightning excites a medley of gases in the lower atmosphere to glow white, blue jets excite mostly stratospheric nitrogen, and they create a very signature blue hue. Now, these so-called blue jets have been observed from the ground in aircraft for years, but it's hard to tell how they form without getting high above the clouds, and so instruments on board the International Space Station have certainly helped. And one thing that they have noted, in addition to having photographed one of these blue jets emerging from an extremely brief bright burst of electricity near the top of a thundercloud, this is also the subject, by the way, of a new paper published in the journal Nature, but indeed we seem to have a better understanding as a result of this. They also touch on some old favorites of ours, sprites and elves. Okay, these are all varieties of upper atmospheric phenomena, and it's actually believed, well, some scientists have proposed, that even as far back as World War II, some pilots were seeing sprites, elves, maybe these blue jets as well, and that had been the source of the sightings of Foo Fighters. Just to be clear, I actually do not think that upper atmospheric lightning phenomena completely explains the Foo Fighter phenomenon. And in fact, back in the archives for ex-subscribers, we did an episode just a while back where we looked at some of the better Foo Fighter reports. I gotta tell you, if the scientists who had proposed those kinds of things, or the journalists who were reporting on that science, if they had gone back and read the better Foo Fighter reports, they might not have been so quick to say that all of them were lightning sprites, elves, and what have you. But I digress. As Maria writes here, cameras and light-sensing instruments called photometers on the space station observed this particular blue jet in a storm that occurred over the Pacific Ocean back in February of last year. According to Torsten Neubert, atmospheric physicist at the Technical University of Denmark, he says, the whole thing starts with what I think of as a blue bang. Then they say that blue bang, a 10-microsecond flash of bright blue light near the top of a cloud, might result from a special kind of short-range electric discharge inside of the thundercloud. At least that is Neubert's working hypothesis. Normal lightning bolts are formed by discharges between oppositely charged regions of a cloud or a cloud and the ground, many kilometers apart. But again, if we're talking about discharges that head upward, it's got to be something a little different happening there, right? As Neubert and colleagues suppose, turbulent mixing high in a cloud might bring oppositely charged regions within about a kilometer of each other, creating a very short but powerful burst of electric current. And indeed, there is some evidence observed from the ground and collected by instrumentation that seems to support this idea. We'll have this story linked in the show notes for you. But another story that Lauren sent along has to do with something that's quite interesting. The term they use is coronasomnia. And of course, what they are describing is people who are suffering from sleepless nights on account of anxiety that stems from the current pandemic situation. That's right, BBC reported on this. They note that so many of us are currently experiencing sleeplessness, and they liken the current situation to being, and they quote Dr. Stephen Altshuler, a psychiatrist and neurologist here, who calls it almost biblical. Yeah, that's how bad the sleeplessness is right now. But Altshuler says, if you're having insomnia, you're in good company. Much of the world is too. It's a consequence of all the changes we're experiencing in COVID. I gotta ask you guys, how many of you out there have felt a distinctive interruption in your sleep cycle? Over the weekend on the X podcast for subscribers, I had mentioned some of my favorite sci-fi stories in audio format. They are freely available on the web. Of course, ex-subscribers, you'll want to listen and find out all about that, but when do I do that listening? You guessed it, in the middle of the night when I can't sleep. If I don't feel like turning on the light and reading, I never watch TV in the middle of the night, by the way. The big reason being that, you know, I try to limit late in the day how much blue light I am taking in. And so one of the reasons I do love audiobooks, not that I don't love podcasts, but being a professional podcaster who produces 4 or 5 of them for a living, you know, I guess I limit the number of podcasts I listen to, although I do have a few favorites, longtime favorites. You know, I love old Joe Rowe, Adam Curry, and John Dvorak as well over there at No Agenda. Some classics in the morning to you, by the way. But if I want to catch up on reading that might actually be useful for show prep for something I'm going to produce, how better to do that than to listen to an audiobook in the evenings, right? So anyway, that's when I do my audiobook listening. But I have noticed an uptick in the number of audiobooks I've purchased over the last few months, and that no doubt having to do with the fact that I'm sleeping less at night, and it seems a lot of people are also suffering from insomnia, or as they call it here, coronasomnia. So if you aren't sleeping well, how do you deal with that? info@micahhanks.com, tweet at me @MicahHanks. I'd like to hear what the listenership does to cope with insomnia. Although I do hope, of course, that you get a good night's sleep. I've also heard about the sleep meditation apps. I haven't tried one of those yet. Do those help? Maybe somebody out there will be kind enough to clue me in on that. Now, one more story I absolutely have to touch on here before we get to a couple of emails and then we bring Dr. Loeb into the mix to discuss Oumuamua. I've followed his work for a very long time. It's going to be a real treat to talk with him. But Lauren had brought to my attention the other day, I thought this was a joke when she texted me this headline. And as it turns out, I'm looking at the story right now, this is obviously no joke. Microsoft has patented a chatbot that could imitate a deceased loved one, celebrity, or fictional character. Okay, celebrity I could kind of understand, sure. Fictional character, that would be cool. Who doesn't want to talk to their favorite character from Harry Potter or Doctor Who or what have you? In fact, many years ago, on the original Graylian Report, Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, and I here in this very studio did an experiment with an early form of AI chatbot technology, which emulated actor William Shatner in his iconic role as Captain James T. Kirk. And we interviewed Captain Kirk live on the radio. That was interesting, I should say, although again, that was fairly limited technology. But with the way that things are going these days, with the direction our technology is headed, I can only imagine that what Microsoft is talking about with this new patent would be far more effective. Now, here are the specifics according to the article here from Business Insider by Grace Kay. She says that Microsoft has been issued a sci-fi sounding patent for a chatbot that could take on another person's personality and likeness. You know, another thing that immediately goes through my head here is, of course, deepfake technology. I mean, we already have technologies where we can have one person look much like another, but take people completely out of the equation and imagine a future, maybe even closer than you think, where there doesn't even have to be a person there. All you need is this chatbot technology, and it could potentially look and behave exactly like another person. But as they mentioned, yes, that could also be someone who we no longer have with us, someone who may have passed on into the great ever after. As Grace tells us, while Microsoft's patent does not specifically say that the product would be used to bring deceased people back to life digitally, the plan does use dead loved ones as an example of how the chatbot could be implemented to recreate and imitate individuals from the real world. Now, psychologically speaking, I could see this as having some benefits, maybe even having some therapeutic benefit. But I also wonder, for instance, part of the therapeutic benefit might be that a chatbot like this could allow someone who maybe lost a loved one very suddenly, and they don't feel like they were able to have the closure they needed on that relationship. Well, this could certainly allow for the perception of that. And no, it's not real closure. We aren't really talking with that deceased person. But it would certainly emulate being able to have that final conversation, wouldn't it? And so as a psychological tool, it might be helpful. And I'll tell you why I think that's the case, because I'm reminded of the clinical work of Raymond Moody, MD. He wrote the books Life After Life and others. But Raymond Moody is the very one who borrowed the idea from the ancient Greeks of the necromantium. He called this the psychomantium, but he would do these therapy sessions with grieving patients, and he would ask them a series of questions about the deceased loved one in question. And then at the end of the session, when he said it got to a point where the person was essentially finished talking about the person that they were missing, he would take them into a room in this barn behind his house that was specially designed, kind of a dark room with a very comfortable chair, candle lit, and there's a mirror across from where the individual sits on the wall above them, directly above them, just about above eye level from where they'd be sitting. And Moody would say, "Now just sit here and I want you to relax and just look into that mirror. And if you need me, I'll be right down the hall here. So you, of course, know I'm nearby, but just sit here and relax and focus on that mirror." And many of the people who, after these therapeutic sessions, would go into this so-called psychomantium and look into this mirror that was above eye level, so they didn't see their own reflection, mind you. They're only kind of staring into this sort of optical depth, this almost illusory kind of infinity of this mirror in this dark room. And many of the participants in these sessions claimed that they actually would see the deceased loved one in question. Some people also said that they were able to hear the loved one and that the loved one would speak to them and that they would actually have an audible interaction. In a few rare cases, the people actually said that an apparition of the person came out of the mirror and spoke to them. Now, that might sound kind of Hollywood, scary, sci-fi, you know, horror film type stuff, but it's not. In these cases, the people felt very comforted. This wasn't spooky at all. These people said that they felt like they were able to, again, have that last conversation. They had the feeling of closure. They were able to bring resolution, in a sense, psychologically at least, to this relationship that ended all too soon. Now, I had a chance to meet Raymond Moody a number of years ago, and I asked him, "Dr. Moody, do you think these people were actually seeing the spirit of a loved one? Or was it a psychological phenomenon?" And Moody told me, "Oh, I definitely think it was psychological. I don't think these are real ghosts by any stretch of the imagination. But it is interesting to me, nonetheless, that under these circumstances, something which seems to have been described in ancient Greek literature, which is partially where he got the idea for it. I actually go into depth into that story in my old book, Magic, Mysticism, and the Molecule, which is more than a decade old now. I've got some other books in the works. But again, this idea has really fascinated me for a long time." And he said, "Yeah, they effectively had experiences where they saw ghosts of these loved ones, but I think it was a psychological phenomenon. It was something that they needed and which this circumstance obviously was conducive to allowing them to feel, to experience, to have." And this, to me, is one of the really interesting things about technology. Because at times, these phenomena which we have called paranormal in the past, people's perception of things like ghosts, you know, psychic phenomena, telepathy, and what have you, many have argued that in the coming years, technology is going to increasingly facilitate for real-world corollaries, if you will, for these kinds of things. You know, thought transmission, communication via thought, and things like that. Technology in the coming years will likely help facilitate that. And it may actually be the case that we will have similar technologies that facilitate a kind of experience with our deceased loved ones, which I could, in that tradition of Moody's work, see as being beneficial, but again, there's also the other side of it too. What if a person begins to feel that they need this AI chatbot that impersonates mom or dad or the aunt or the uncle, and the person begins to perceive that as actually being that person, when in fact it's just AI? You know, that could also present some problems, too. What are your thoughts on that? Again, hit me on Twitter at MicahHanks or info@MicahHanks.com. I'd love to get some ideas from you guys out there in the listening audience about that one. And speaking of ideas from the listening audience, I have just enough time for a few emails here. Now, Ian, actually, he wrote to me via Twitter. And Ian writes, "Hi, just wondering what you thought of this as you keep referring to the last ice age, as apparently we are still in it. At least five major ice ages have occurred throughout Earth's history. The earliest was over 2 billion years ago, and the most recent one began approximately 3 million years ago and continues today. He says, yes, we live in an ice age. Currently, we are in a warm interglacial that began about 11,000 years ago. Again, love the show, and make of this what you will. I think I see what Ian is saying there, that there have been major climate changes that have occurred, and again, the peaks of those representative of five main instances over the last several billions of years, and compared to warmer temperatures maybe we have seen in the past, we're still technically in a cooler trend, right? But again, in general discussion by geologists, and recognizing the difference between the last geological epoch, that is the Pleistocene, and then the one that we currently inhabit, the Holocene, although there are some, by the way, who would say, oh, see, you're wrong there also. We are now in the Anthropocene. Now, it has been proposed by some scientists, and some geologists also recognize the current moment here in time as being essentially still the very beginning of an all-new geological epoch, and they call that the Anthropocene. And adherents of that idea generally would recognize the Second World War and the introduction of nuclear weapons as being the beginning of the Anthropocene. But presently there is not consensus among the scientific community. There are some who say we should recognize this as the Anthropocene. You also have geologists and others who say, well, again, that's not consensus, that's a proposed idea. Some still recognize the current epoch as the Holocene. Make of that what you will. My point is that I refer to the last ice age using the generally accepted terminology by geologists, climate scientists, and what have you, in reference to the Pleistocene, where we had a whole lot more glaciation on Earth than what we currently have. So, getting to the next message here, Freeman writes, the show you did on the Forgotten Lands was very interesting. I don't remember hearing about the Phoenician disinformation about the Atlantic being impassable before, but that sounds like them. I thought that the part about the Azores called for more information about Azorean underwater archaeology. I hit this right away, and he sends along an article from the Portuguese American Journal talking about alleged pyramids found on the island of Pico. He says, it sounds like there's more right in front of our noses than what usually gets publicized. Well, I would agree, Freeman. In fact, it had been the stories of the pyramids on Pico that initially brought the mysteries of the Azores to my attention. That very article, in fact. And although I didn't go and see those, I certainly found plenty of other things that are at very least suggestive of earlier occupation of the Azores. And by the way, again, I continue to get all kinds of emails. I believe Stuart Young tweeted at me the other day also. Lots of good feedback on the Forgotten Lands episode. People obviously are very interested in the ancient mysteries side of things. And although I should point out, over on the Seven Ages audio journal, that entire podcast is dedicated to archaeology, and people who enjoy those shows that I do on this podcast, you'll certainly enjoy the Seven Ages audio journal, although I will say that that program takes a much more academic approach to archaeology. We talk primarily with archaeologists. I think that's very needed in the dialogue, especially in a kind of podcasting environment where most of the discussion of archaeology is speculative. There are TV stars and there are self-proclaimed experts who are interviewed rather than people who have gone to school and who are professionals in the discipline of archaeology. So that's what Jason and James and I do on the Seven Ages audio journal. But I'll certainly try to incorporate more of that kind of discussion in the future on this program. Two more quick messages. Actually, maybe just one more right now. I may have to save some for the future. We've got to get Dr. Loeb in on the call, but Nate writes, Eve to you, sir. Thank you for the societal greetings, by the way, there, Nate. He says, I'm likely the 10th person to send you this, but just in case, in Popular Mechanics, the article Major New Legislation Calls for Bigfoot Hunting Season. And he sends that link. Don't worry, Nate, you are actually only the 8th person who has sent it to me. He also adds, some great shows recently, though we do miss Race Hobbs and Matt Oakley. Hey, you know what? So do I. Everybody's schedules are crazy these days, but you know, I keep thinking of a way I could get all of the old gang back together again and maybe do some live video streams, maybe even, not just podcasts or live audio. Maybe I will pursue that. But Nate says, please keep those high-quality episodes coming. I really think you've gone from strength to strength since you clarified your position on certain topics, like UFO contactees, with your usual precision and solid reasoning. Stay well, Nate. Well, thank you very much, Nate. And by the way, yet again, another of these supplemental podcasts. If you head over to SasquatchTracks.com, That is the other podcast I produce with Dakota Waddell and Jeff Smith. And we take a very similar approach. We are talking with anthropologists. We are talking to citizen scientists, naturalists, people who take the idea of relict hominoids, i.e. creatures like Sasquatch, very seriously. That is the main thrust of that program. And I would say that really, if you look for the common thread between all my shows, each show maybe takes a slightly different subject. I mean, everyone can tell really that my main loves are history, anthropology, and probably astronomy too, as far as the sciences. And hence we talk a lot about space on this show, but of course we also discuss the idea of the search for extraterrestrial life, and also the possibility that certain phenomena observed in the world, like UFOs, might actually represent that. But the common thread between all my shows is that we take those kinds of ideas that are often sensational and entirely too speculative in a modern popular format. I try to bring scientists to the table, and I try to engage with the scientific community and talk about these subjects and how science might actually broaden our understanding of them. So, if you've got ideas and feedback you'd like to share, info@micahanks.com is the way to do that. I'll look forward to hearing from you. And in that tradition of getting scientists on the mic to discuss the mysteries of space-time and the cosmos, when we return, we will be joined by Harvard astronomer Avi Loeb to discuss his new book, Extraterrestrial, right here on the Micah Hanks program. If alien life were ever to visit our planet, or even just our solar system, what might it look like? What form would it take? And what would be their reasons for coming here? More importantly, would we even recognize them, or realize they had been here at all? According to NASA, the first known interstellar object to visit our solar system, Oumuamua, was discovered October 19, 2017, by the University of Hawaii's Pan-STARRS 1 telescope, funded by NASA's Near Earth Object Observations Program, which finds and tracks asteroids and comets in Earth's neighborhood. While originally classified as a comet, observations revealed no signs of cometary activity after it slingshotted past the Sun on September 9, 2017, at a blistering speed of 196,000 miles per hour. Oumuamua was briefly classified as an asteroid until new measurements found it was accelerating slightly, a sign it behaves more like a comet. Today, most astronomers still believe that Oumuamua was either an asteroid, a comet, or some similar space object, albeit a strange one. However, not everyone agrees on that point. And a few scientists have even been willing to come forward with more exotic ideas about what Oumuamua might have been, and more broadly, what that could actually mean for us here as Earthlings. And one of those individuals joins me now. Dr. Avi Loeb is an Israeli-American theoretical physicist who works on astrophysics and cosmology. He is the Frank B. Baird, Jr. Professor of Science at Harvard University and received a Ph.D. in physics from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem in Israel at age 24. This in addition to leading the first international project supported by the Strategic Defense Initiative between 1983 and 1988 and many other achievements. He has also written 8 books, and today we will discuss his most recent one, Extraterrestrial, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and soon to hit the shelves, where he presents the case that an interstellar object observed by astronomers just a few years ago might represent evidence of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. Dr. Loeb, first and foremost, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It is truly a honor, and I've followed your work for a long time, read many of your papers, co-authored, and also individual contributions. Let's get right to the subject at hand, Extraterrestrial, your book, I Feel, which you were kind enough to send along an advanced copy. I feel it could be summarized as a scientist's attempt to present a very rational argument, but for an idea that perhaps due to certain cultural stigmas is seen as being exotic and maybe even to some, even unlikely. That idea, of course, has to do with whether extraterrestrial life exists elsewhere in our universe and how science can be applied toward studying and resolving this great question. May I first begin by asking you why you feel like this idea is met with the kind of aversion that it sometimes sees?
Well, that's the biggest mystery to me, because for a variety of reasons. One is the public is extremely excited about this question, and how dare the scientists not examine it if they have the tools to do so. This subject is at the periphery of astronomy right now, the search for extraterrestrial civilizations, and not in the mainstream. And it has been like that for, you know, seven decades since the very first search for radio signals started. And I don't fully understand that, because over the past few years, we realized that, you know, of other half of all the sun-like stars have an Earth-sized planet at the right distance from the star to have liquid water on its surface and the chemistry of life as we know it. And if you roll the dice billions of times in the Milky Way galaxy alone, you know, what is the chance that we are unique and special? I would say very small. And not only that, I would say, you know, first of all, if you arrange for the same conditions that we find on Earth on so many other places, it's very likely that you get similar outcomes. So we are sort of round of the mill, the typical type of life that you might find, intelligent life. But we are definitely not the sharpest cookie in the jar. So that's the second question. If we are not alone, you know, are we the smartest kid on the block? And I would argue that we are probably not. For two reasons. You open the morning newspaper, you realize we are doing a lot of things that are not good for us in the long term. More importantly, you know, when you open recipe books, you can see that out of the same ingredients, you can make very different cakes depending on how you put them together and whether you add heat and so forth. And what's the chance that all the chemicals that were cooked together on the surface of the Earth by random processes ended up making the very best cake that you can imagine? The chances are small. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, other circumstances could lead to much more intelligent beings out there. And also, if they had more time than we did for developing technologies, their technologies would be far more advanced than ours, because ours develops right now. The technologies develop on a time scale of order a few years. And just imagine what technology would be like 100 years from now, 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years, or 1,000,000,000 years. And, you know, the sun formed relatively late in the history of star formation in the universe. And so we are relatively late bloomers, so to speak. And there are so many other sun-like stars that formed billions of years earlier than the sun. And in fact, some of them died by now already. They consumed all their nuclear fuel. If there are intelligent beings out there, you know, if they're still around, they're much more sophisticated than we are. So I start from a point of view of modesty. I think, you know, that's the best approach to life. You know, humans early on in history thought that we are at the center of the universe. You know, Aristotle, a great philosopher, considered very smart for 1,000 years. People believe what he said. Put the Earth and us at the middle of the universe. And, you know, that's a natural thing to do. I see that, you know, when I look at my daughters, when they were infants, they tended to think the world centers on them. But then they went out to the street and they saw other kids and they got a better perspective. And, you know, we as a civilization did not mature yet. We haven't yet realized that we are not at the center of the action. I mean, we did realize that we're not the center of the physical universe. You know, it took some time to recognize that, and Galileo was put on house arrest as a result of philosophers disagreeing with him and not willing to look through his telescopes. But eventually, you know, people look through telescopes, we realize, you know, we are not at the center of the solar system. We are not even, the solar system is not at the center of the galaxy. The galaxy is not the center of the universe. There is really no center, and it makes no sense to talk about us being at the center of the physical universe. But people still have the luxury of believing that we are at the center of the living universe, the biological universe. We are unique. We are special. We are really unusual. And there is nothing out there. And not only that, the astronomy community, you know, the mainstream says, let's not talk about it. Let's not discuss the possibility that something unusual, you know, some unusual object that came to our vicinity could have been produced by another civilization, because it looks so weird. It doesn't look like any asteroid or comet that we have seen before. So it all boils down to this stubbornness of making us special, which I attribute to being arrogant. Basically, why would we believe that there is nothing out there? Only if we are arrogant. And that turned out to be the wrong attitude throughout human history. And how dare we think that way? You know, we are such small creatures on the surface of such a small planet. You know, there are 10 to the 20 planets like Earth in the observable volume of the universe. And, you know, it's more than the number of grains of sand on all the beaches on Earth. And, you know, even if you conquer a piece of land on Earth, like the emperors or kings used to do, and they got very proud of themselves, that's just like an ant hugging a single grain of sand on the landscape of a huge beach, you know. So obviously the universe teaches us modesty. You know, astronomy, when you look at the sky, you realize, you know, you can't be anything other than modest and humble. And that means approaching everything from the Copernican principle that we are not at the center of anything, and that we should look for evidence before we conclude things. You know, we shouldn't put Galileo in house arrest. We shouldn't pay attention to how many likes we get on Twitter. We should just check the evidence and see, you know, what it tells us.
Yes, certainly. And Dr. Loeb, I must acknowledge right here at the outset, I can tell this is going to be one conversation for the books. We are talking, indeed, with Dr. Avi Loeb of Harvard University. His new book is Extraterrestrial, and we will discuss more of that and the enigmatic Oumuamua when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Mysterious than an interstellar space object careening through our solar system. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad to be here to be your host, and especially glad to be joined this week by Dr. Avi Loeb, an astronomer whose work I have followed for a very long time. We have a whole lot to get into with him, so allow me to be brief in saying, if you aren't already a subscriber to this program, an ex-subscriber, you're missing out because you're only getting part of the conversation. Indeed, every week we go deeper down the rabbit hole with the additional X podcasts, and of course we have the monthly Enigmas specials too. You can find all of that information there at MicahHanks.com/podcast, up in the upper right hand corner of the page. Just click X memberships. That's all you need to make your way down here into the bunker. And now, without further ado, I want to waste no time and getting back into this conversation with Dr. Avi Loeb. His new book is Extraterrestrial, and he presents the novel, perhaps even heretical and certainly revolutionary hypothesis, that indeed Oumuamua, this strange space object observed first just a few years ago and remaining very mysterious, that indeed this may be the first scientific proof of alien life. That remains to be seen, but again, it is certainly an idea worthy of consideration. Dr. Loeb, I've heard over the years so many talk about this. Sagan, of course, arguably popularized these ideas more than anyone. The notion that if other civilizations exist, they would face many of the same perils that we will. Their sun will eventually burn out. Extinction is inevitable unless technology helps them to overcome it. In which case, if we are looking for evidence of intelligent civilizations that either do exist, or maybe at least at one time did exist, we're going to find remnants of their technologies which were in the furtherance of overcoming some of the very issues that we as humans face here on Earth. Climate changes, you know, the eventuality of our own sun burning out. We look at the efforts to get to Mars. Humans see right now space exploration as being a necessity for our eventual survival. So it only stands to reason that perhaps other civilizations will have attempted the same and maybe got a little further along with that than we have.
Exactly. So looking at the sky for evidence would provide us with important lessons. For example, if some civilizations killed themselves, developed the technologies that led to their own destruction, you know, that could teach us a lesson to behave better and not to ruin the planet on which we stand. But beyond that, there might be some commercial opportunities out there. If you were able to detect some technology that was not yet developed on Earth, that is far more advanced than we have here, and import it to Earth, you can make a fortune out of it. And it's a better approach to making money than going to Wall Street or to Silicon Valley, potentially. We can learn a lot from entities that are more advanced than we are. And all we need to do is use the technologies we have to search. Let me give you an example of how stubborn the astronomy community is. We are right now, the search for microbial life, primitive life, is regarded part of the mainstream. And there are various missions that or telescopes that are being designed with the goal of detecting, for example, oxygen in the atmospheres of other planets. And oxygen might be an indicator for microbial life because that's the way it's produced on Earth. But on the other hand, oxygen can be produced naturally by breaking water molecules or other chemical processes. And it would never be absolutely clear that if you detect oxygen, it means life exists. However, if you use the same telescopes that are being designed to search for CFCs, these molecules that are produced by industrial pollution on Earth, they cannot be produced by natural processes. They are too complex. And if you detect them, that would be clear evidence that intelligent life, or maybe not so intelligent, but industrial life exists on another planet. So that would be beyond any doubt a signature of life. Compared to oxygen, where there will always be doubt. There was doubt also about phosphine when it was reported in the cloud deck of Venus. Mm-hmm. My point is that it makes no sense because we're building these telescopes. They can look for CFCs as much as they look for oxygen, and I wrote a paper about it. But the astronomy community is refusing to include in the discussion the motivation to look for industrial pollution. And why would that be the case? What could be a reason not to search for that? I mean, and only search for oxygen? Only if you have a prejudice or if you want not to work on something that the public is really interested in because you regard that not an occupation of the elite. I mean, I simply do not understand why this would not be part of the mainstream. It's a conservative approach to say that the same outcome can be arranged out of the same circumstances. So if you repeat the conditions on Earth in other places, you might get the same outcome. What could be more conservative than that? And just to give you an example, I mean, astronomers are searching for the nature of the dark matter, what most of the matter in the universe is. And there were all kinds of proposals for what kind of particles the dark matter may be. And hundreds of millions of dollars were spent on that, searching for the nature of the dark matter, with so far only upper limits and constraints that rule out models that were proposed. And My question is, why is that less speculative? Why should we invest hundreds of millions of dollars on that and not on the search for intelligent life when we have the technology to do both? Why would one be regarded part of the mainstream and appropriate and the other not? And what could be better than figuring out if we are alone or not?
Yes, we would learn, I think, an awful lot about ourselves. We are talking with Harvard professor Avi Loeb, also the author of the new book, Extraterrestrial. Avi, one thing I think that really concerns me about conjectures in science, particularly in the field of physics, is that when they appear to help resolve an idea or a theory or a cherished opinion, they often tend to receive more support. You mentioned dark matter. It's a prime example. And that while scientists have yet to find a way to detect it or observe it directly, the conjecture is widely accepted since it helps to make our view of the universe and its mysteries a little less complicated. Do you feel that perhaps the implication that extraterrestrial technology could have been observed as recently as 2017, as we're about to discuss, is that a idea that for some reason maybe complicates our view of the universe, or at very least our conceptions about it, and therefore it is met with more resistance?
Well, I think it has great, it carries great implications, and that's why we should consider it. We should not shy away from complicated material just because we are afraid of the consequences. That would be similar to burying our head in the sand and not looking because we might not like what we see. I mean, but that's not the approach of a realist or someone that wants to figure out what reality is like. You know, we can live on our planet and our civilization will perish without knowing anything about the outside world, and that would be fine. You know, animals do that. They live and they don't, you know, they don't do science. And, you know, it's a possible way to live, to be ignorant. But I'm trying to propose a better approach, which is to know what is going on out there by collecting information. You know, not looking through Galileo's telescope did not make the sun move around the earth. It just made some people more ignorant. And that's my point, that, you know, if we don't want to remain ignorant, we should collect evidence. And in particular about objects that look like they are anomalous, that came to our solar system from outside. Perhaps there is space junk or some debris out there that would be a different approach to search for alien technologies, other than looking for radio signals, for example. So that's my point. And, you know, I try to advocate the theme of asking my colleagues to behave more like kids. You know, I wrote an article for the Harvard Gazette. I was asked, what is the one thing you would change about the world? And I said, you know, I would like more of my colleagues to behave like kids, being curious about the world around them, willing to make mistakes. And regarding science as a learning experience, not about demonstrating their superiority relative to other people or boosting their ego, or building an echo chamber where people repeat what you say, as often the case with students and postdocs. It's more about learning new things. And, you know, that's what I signed up for. That's what I pursued as a kid, and I'm trying to continue along the same path now.
Yes, there is a reason why often wonder is referred to as childlike. I think we could all stand to incorporate a little more of that into our process of inquiry, especially when it relates to science.
I wanted to add one more
thing,
because you mentioned the dark matter, but mm-hmm. The dark matter is motivated by, again, an anomaly, the fact that we see more evidence for stronger gravity than we can associate with the visible matter. And then we say there must be more matter out there that is producing that gravity. So it's an indirect inference. But at least there is evidence for it. And the evidence started with Fritz Zwicky, you know, in 1940 or so. He was not liked by many people, but he argued there is dark matter, and that was not a popular subject at the time. But my point is, this is on a relatively empirical basis that we argue there is that. But then you have a whole community of theoretical physicists talking for several decades now, maybe almost 40 years, about extra dimensions, something that we have never witnessed, and setting the foundations of string theory on that and talking about the multiverse that we have no way of detecting directly as part of the mainstream. And the other scientists talking about us living in a simulation or all kinds of, and supersymmetry is the foundation to the popular version of string theory. And supersymmetry was tested by the Large Hadron Collider, and in its simplest form, it was ruled out experimentally. So you ask yourself, how come all these ideas for which prizes are awarded and for which people are very proud of themselves exploring, how come these are part of the mainstream, all these speculations, whereas just arguing that the same thing that happens in one system happens in another system that shares its physical properties, which is what we are talking about, that another planet that has the same conditions as Earth does, goes through very similar processes. How come that is not part of the mainstream? And, I find that it's an unhealthy situation in present day science. The fact that it's all about doing intellectual gymnastics more than about figuring out what nature is about.
Absolutely. And we have a lot of questions about nature. But I also have a lot of questions specifically about Oumuamua. For our guest, Dr. Avi Loeb of Harvard University, indeed one of the most distinguished scientists who has ever argued that science may have found proof of alien life, we will delve into this in greater depth when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. I realize this may come as a surprise to the listeners of the Micah Hanks Program, but I am fascinated with the idea of extraterrestrial life, whether it exists, if it is out there, if it has ever come a little closer to home. Home in the earthly sense of things, of course. Welcome back. Our guest, Dr. Avi Loeb, is also one who wonders these very same things. And in fact, has done, in my opinion, one of the most respectable things that a scientist can do. He has put his reputation at stake and advanced a hypothesis that in a lot of ways may not fall in step with consensus thinking, especially in astronomy, but really more broadly in the sciences. And really, I think it is very important, even if one day we realize Oumuamua was just an asteroid or a comet. Whatever unlikely circumstances might allow for that, we're going to look back on the work of people like Dr. Avi Loeb, and we're going to remember that that was paradigm-changing. But if he ends up being right, then we are really on the cusp of a paradigm change. Now, some would argue, Dr. Loeb, that the simplest and most parsimonious explanation for what we observed with this interstellar object is that it was an asteroid or some similar object, but a strange one. What are the circumstances that brought you as a scientist to feel that this notion should be challenged?
Well, at first people thought it's a comet because most of the objects that are torn apart from the solar system come from the outer regions where they're coated with ice, and they become comets when they pass close to a star that warms up the ice, and then you get a cometary tail. And so, in fact, a decade ago, we wrote a paper with two colleagues of mine, Amaya Moore-Martin and Ed Turner, where we forecasted how many such interstellar objects should exist. And we predicted that the Pan-STARRS, the telescope that discovered Oumuamua, will not see anything. We were wrong. The abundance of objects like Oumuamua needs to be orders of magnitude larger than one would expect based on the solar system in order to explain the detection of Oumuamua. And that was the first surprise. But then people said, oh, man, it's probably a comet. And they looked for a cometary tail. When it came close to the sun, there was no tail. And the Spitzer Space Telescope looked very closely and didn't find any evidence for carbon-based molecules coming off it. And that put a very tight limit on the possibility that there is ice on its surface and it's evaporating. But then the surprise came that it exhibited a push away from the sun that you often find with comets. So people said, well, at first they said comet, but then they said, oh, there is no cometary tail. It must be an asteroid, just rock. But then it did exhibit a push. But what is pushing it if there is no gas coming off it, no rocket effect? And that's the real puzzle that I attempted at that point, you know, when this was discussed, that I felt, well, this object is really unusual. We should be open-minded about it. It may not be natural. And in addition, this object, of course, was changing its brightness by a factor of 10 as it was tumbling around. And that implies, because it reflects sunlight, so that's the light that we get from it. And it means that the area on the sky that it occupies changes by a factor of 10 as it tumbles. And that means that it has a very extreme geometry. And people that try to fit the amount of light that we received over time as it tumbled concluded that at the 90% confidence that it must be flattened. It must be pancake-like rather than cigar-shaped the way it was depicted in many cartoons. So here you have a pancake-like object the size of a football field, and it's being pushed by something. And what is this something? And we considered the possibility in a paper that we wrote with my postdoc, Shmuel Bialy, a couple of years ago. We considered the possibility that it might be pushed by sunlight bouncing off it. And that implies that it must be very thin. Nature does not produce very thin surfaces. So we concluded it might be a light sail, an artificial object that is pushed by sunlight. This is a technology that we are currently developing here on Earth. A light sail is just like a sail on a sailboat that is being pushed by the wind, by air bouncing off it. But in the case of a light sail, it's the light that bounces off it that gives it a push. And that could explain the extra push that this object exhibited. It needs to have a very large surface-to-weight ratio. I should say that, okay, so this proposal that it's artificial was met with a lot of pushback, but any serious astronomer that tried to explain the known facts about Oumuamua had to argue that it's nothing that we have seen before. For example, there was a proposal that it's a hydrogen iceberg, something that we have never seen before. And that's why we don't see a cometary tail, because hydrogen is transparent. You can't see it when it evaporates off the iceberg. We actually showed in a paper that it would have evaporated along its journey if it was made of hydrogen. So it cannot be a hydrogen iceberg. It's too fragile. And then some other people suggested maybe it's a dust bunny. You know, the kind of collection of dust that you find in your at home. If it's a dust bunny, then it's very lightweight for its area, and that's why it's being pushed by sunlight. The problem with that is, again, a dust bunny would not be a stable configuration that would survive over a long distance of a journey. And then there was a suggestion, maybe it's a fragment from the disruption of an object by a star. But most of the objects do not pass very close to a star to be disrupted this way. And besides, if it will be disrupted, a fragment would look elongated rather than flat. So, people went to great effort to explain the unusual properties of Oumuamua. And nevertheless, the mainstream people continue to say, business as usual, forget about it, it's nonsense, we should not even consider the possibility that it's artificial. And again, I find that being guided by prejudice and not really seeking more evidence to figure out what it is. In analogy to a caveman that is used to playing with rocks all of his life and then sees a cell phone, you know, and obviously the caveman would say, you know, this cell phone is a shiny rock.
Right, yes. Or that would be what it appeared like to him. I remember when the publication of your paper with Bieli, Could Solar Radiation Pressure Explain Oumuamua's Peculiar Acceleration, was published. I also remember the feedback that you got, and some of it was more akin to pushback. But from reading your book, and of course from having followed your work, it seems evident to me when we were talking about the intellectual gymnastics that you've talked about, right, that there's a fair bit of that that some have put toward trying to create quote-unquote normal explanations for Oumuamua. In other words, they seem to have to kind of argue in roundabout ways to be able to make this fit a natural explanation. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, but your contention is that in this case, a more parsimonious conclusion might be that we are observing something which behaves in many ways like the technologies we are currently developing for advanced space probes.
Exactly. And all I'm saying is we should be alert. And the next object that comes along that looks weird, we should get as much evidence as possible about it and perhaps photograph it by passing close to it if it comes our way. All I'm asking is for the astronomy community to take this possibility seriously, the possibility of a message in a bottle. And, I don't see any downside of learning about interstellar objects. At the very least, we will figure out that there are environments that make objects that look very different from the objects in the solar system. So I think it's a frontier of the future. And just as I go on the beach on a vacation and look at seashells that were swept ashore, you know, they're quite beautiful. Each of them is naturally made and looks different. And every now and then I see a plastic bottle. And that indicates that there is a civilization out there, and it's ours. I should also mention an anecdote that in September 2020, there was a new object very similar to the orbit of the Earth, 2020 SO. And the astronomers found that in 1966, it intercepted the Earth. And then they realized, well, there was a Surveyor 2 lunar lander that was launched in that year, and it had a rocket booster that was expelled into space, and it was hollow, and this was it. And indeed, this object was quite unusual in the sense that it exhibited an extra push from sunlight because it had a large surface-to-mass ratio, similar to Oumuamua. So that, to me, is an illustration of the possibility that, you know, we can tell the difference between an artificial object and a natural object by observing its motion and seeing a force different from what gravity would give us. And in addition, not recognizing any cometary tail. And 2020 SO was obviously made by us. But the Oumuamua came from outside the solar system. So, you know, if it's artificial, there must be someone else out there.
And again, yes, demonstrating this, or rather a deviation from Keplerian orbit, which just fascinates me. Dr. Avi Loeb is our guest. And I want to ask him now, as you have mentioned in the conversation already, the idea of a message in a bottle. There are other interpretations of what Oumuamua, if of intelligent design, and perhaps extraterrestrial origin, might represent. In addition to the idea of a light sail, there is the notion that it could be a derelict craft or probe, something that may not even be performing active reconnaissance, but which may be a remnant of some lost civilization. Could we discuss that a bit?
Yeah, so there are various possibilities. This object was also unusual in that it was nearly at rest in the local galactic parking lot. That's, you know, the frame of reference where you average over the motion of all the stars in the neighborhood of the sun, and it was almost at rest there. And only one in 500 stars is so much at rest in that frame. So we basically, the solar system bumped into it. It was not moving in the galactic frame. You know, that's a place to put, if you put a car in a public parking lot, nobody would know where the car came from. So you can ask about various reasons for doing that. First, it's not possible to trace the origin of this object. But perhaps it serves as a relay station for communication. You know, if you want to communicate across large distances, you might put a grid of relay stations across the galaxy. Another possibility is for navigation. It may be used to find your way through, for, you know, spacecrafts navigating through interstellar space. Or it could be some space junk, some layer of material that was torn off a spacecraft. Or it could be some equipment that is defunct by now, that stopped operating because its time expired. It's very old. Or it could be a probe that was sent to the habitable region of the solar system to figure out what's going on there. And although it's not transmitting right now, at some point it will send a signal back to where it was sent from. And who knows? Without more evidence, we can't tell. And it may, you know, it may be just a naturally produced object that looks extremely weird. And that's also a possibility. I'm just saying, let's find out by observing these things. Let's not act like the philosophers in the days of Galileo that refused to look through a telescope because they thought they know the answer in advance.
Yes, and this is certainly something we continue to see in science today, actually in a variety of different disciplines as well. People who will not look at new evidence, or any evidence for that matter, that might conflict with their presuppositions. We are talking with Dr. Avi Loeb of Harvard University. His new book is Extraterrestrial, and we will wrap up this conversation about the enigmatic Oumuamua when we return right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Including a fascinating conversation about the potential that we may have reached a new milestone in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Keep in mind, we will have some additional audio for X subscribers from this conversation with Dr. Avi Loeb, a person who I truly respect, whose work I have followed for a very long time, and whom I still have a few questions for. Now, another area that we absolutely have to get into here as it relates to the questions about Oumuamua, Dr. Loeb, and this is something I've really wanted to ask you about for a very long time. In your book, Extraterrestrial, another point that you make is that we may actually be in a bad position if we don't entertain the possibility, if we intentionally and purposefully overlook what may be staring us in the face. Now, the proposition that extraterrestrial life might exist and that we are on the verge of having the ability to detect evidence of it raises certain existential questions. I know that that's sort of a theme that your book follows also. Let me ask you, Doctor, are we as humans prepared to accept maybe that we are alone in the universe, or that this evidence may actually be observable now?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't think we are ready based on the reaction of both the scientific community, mainly the scientific community, I should say, and some parts of the general public, but mostly the scientific community. And that's surprising to me because, you know, we learn something from the history of science, and that is that prejudice should be abandoned, and we should look for evidence to guide us about what reality is like. And we keep forgetting that, despite the atrocities that happened throughout human history when people refused to look at the evidence. You know, reality is the thing that never goes away, even if you ignore it. It's still out there. It doesn't matter what you do. It's not about you as the observer. We're trying to figure out what is beyond you, the observer, so that we can decide how to act accordingly. You know, if we find evidence for life elsewhere, it will change our perspective.
You know, another area from where these sorts of questions arise, Doctor, is the realm of science fiction. And I think that it's important to bring that up in the context of the conversation, too, because ideas, and you address this in the book, ideas like alien invasion and certain motifs that are represented in popular cinema perhaps have done little to encourage serious involvement from the scientific community in relation to questions about extraterrestrials. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's true. Many of these ideas violate the laws of physics, and that's why I don't like most of the science fiction literature or cinema, but I do like some movies and some books, especially those that do not, that are in accordance with the laws of physics, because otherwise it bothers me and I cannot enjoy them aesthetically. But, you know, they are good as media or platforms for thinking broadly and coming up with new ideas that could potentially guide us into the future. You know, there were some ideas that Jules Verne came up with that are now realized, and including the submarine. And so this intellectual exercise of thinking about possibilities is a good one. In fact, let me mention in this context, I wrote a Scientific American article about Noah's spaceship. Basically, the idea is that when Noah, in the biblical story, realized that a great flood is about to come, he wanted to save the animals by building an ark. And by the way, the dimensions of the ark are mentioned explicitly in the Old Testament in the Bible, and they are quite similar to the dimensions of Oumuamua for some reason.
Ah, interesting.
But at any event, he, according to the story, he put animals in it and saved them. Now you can think about a similar situation on Earth. There will be a catastrophe at some point. Within a billion years, the sun will warm up and boil off all the oceans on Earth. That's, you know, the longest we can imagine living here. But even before that, there would be an asteroid hitting the Earth or some other self-inflicted wound that we would impose. And so the question is, how currently all our eggs are in one basket. How do we spread our eggs so that, you know, something would survive, that we would not lose everything in one blow, one catastrophe? And you know, that's the same trick that the Gutenberg Bible, the printing press, invented. That prior to the printing press, there were handwritten copies of the Bible, and each of them was precious. But once the printing press produced a lot of them, then if something bad happens to one, it's not a catastrophe. It's not a, you know. And the same you can think about life on Earth. If you were to spread it in many places, then if a catastrophe hits Earth, then, you know, it's not, I mean, it's bad, but it, something else will survive. And so can we build the Noah's spaceship that will carry everything we care about to other locations? And I mean, you might think, oh, we need to build a huge spaceship because we need to put elephants and whales and birds and lots of other things on it. The answer is no. With modern science, all you care about is the DNA, the genetic information. And as long as we know how to produce synthetic life out of the raw materials that we may find on another planet, then all you need is a CubeSat that has an advanced computer, artificial intelligence, and a 3D printer with the information of how to produce the DNA of all forms of life that we care about. And that could be a small spacecraft, just, you know, a CubeSat, and you launch that and then you land it on planets and recreate life out of the raw materials there. You might think this is science fiction, but to me, it's also an interesting science challenge to think about.
Oh, I wouldn't think that is exclusive to science fiction at all, although recent history certainly has shown many great ideas, which become science later, have their genesis in science fiction. Dr. Loeb, again, it has been a pleasure to speak with you. I certainly hope it will not be the last time. Your book is Extraterrestrial. When does it actually hit the bookshelves?
The 26th of January, 2021.
Excellent. Well, I hope everyone will purchase a copy and read it. I certainly enjoyed mine, and thank you for being my guest.
Thank you for having me.
And in fact, I hope, if we are lucky, perhaps we will have future opportunities to talk with Dr. Loeb. He has been very kind, gracious, in fact, in terms of making himself available for this discussion. We will have the link to his website where you can learn more about him and, of course, where you can get the book online available for you in the show notes. It will be dropping almost perfectly coinciding with when this podcast appears online. And so, again, it has been my pleasure to speak with Dr. Avi Loeb. And just to conclude this conversation, keep in mind, of course, we'll have some additional audio snippets for X subscribers. But in terms of what this conversation may mean, I mean, the immediate implications are obvious already. But I would contend that even if Oumuamua does not end up being what Dr. Loeb and others think it might be, we can still learn from this conversation. This is a conversation we really must be having. That's one reason why over the last several weeks, in fact, on this program, we have really looked at the idea of alien life, as well as human origins on this planet. You know, looking back to the ancient past, could the question of whether alien life exists really tell us an awful lot about life here on Earth? Because we really don't know. We have nothing to compare it, really ourselves, life as Earthlings know it, and as we know it only from our limited experience here on Earth. We don't really have anything to compare it to. We don't know truly what it means yet to be alive. To answer those questions, we must be able to compare it to life from other worlds, if it exists. And therefore, I couldn't imagine a more Grailian question, if you will, because this is essentially the modern Grail quest. The item that we search, the answers that we seek, will not only answer the great question of whether we are alone in the universe, it's going to tell us a lot about what it means to be alive right here on Earth. And so the trailblazing work of scientists like Avi Loeb, I do believe in future generations, it will be remembered as perhaps not only mind-expanding and a challenge to the status quo, but ultimately it may prove to be paradigm-shifting. In the weeks ahead, we will have many more great conversations here on the Micah Hanks program, but I want to thank every one of you out there who have listened and tuned in around the world, and of course, always, to the X subscribers who support our efforts. So that wraps it up for this week. This show is produced in Asheville, North Carolina. Our executive producers back at Master Control are Race Hobbs and Warren Breger. News tips are provided by Mark Brady, Janet Fitzgerald, and Adam Olson. Music featured on the show is produced by Caleb Hanks and yours truly. And other show content for this program is produced every week by the wonderful Lauren Ellis. Special thanks goes out to Chris Hayes, Tyler Pittman, Robin Hobbs, Tiffany Mack, Jason Pintrail, James Waldo, and Matthew Oakley. I am Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here in the bunker, thanks for listening. And as always, stay strange out there.